You're on the right track. There's no question. It was like a fence in order to straighten it. And Gemara itself is going to say that. Okay? Yeah. But as I say, right now then, the effect of this would be that actually we are creating like 3-day holidays. Not bad if it's a nice weekend or something like that. But this would be the effect of it, because not only the day itself is a day of rejoicing, but also the day before it and the day after it. We're not allowed to fast on either of those days. Okay? So now they say, okay, good. The case of Gedaliah ben Chachikam, all right, so he said, all right, in the time of the Second Temple they didn't observe it, so it was a day of gladness, right? And therefore, we have to say that the day before it, which is the second day of Tishrei, is also a day of gladness, because it's a day before a day of gladness. You follow me so far? Huh? Yeah? Okay, good. So now they ask the question as follows, they say. So they say, Shalafana, you're telling me about the day before? He says, Nami Sipoklei. I can have a different reason why I don't fast on that day, when it's a holiday, rather. Why? Ba'avalei Yom Shalachar Rosh Chodesh. Because it is the day after Rosh Chodesh. Now, when it says Rosh Chodesh, we have to understand, what is Rosh Chodesh Tishrei? It's Rosh Hashanah. Okay? Because today we automatically observe 2 days Rosh Hashanah, the first and the second. So the kasha wouldn't arise today, okay? But in those days, when it was what? It was based upon whether they had seen the moon or not, right? Then in that case, in Eretz Yisrael, how many days Rosh Hashanah did they observe then? They observed normally one. As I said, we'll learn later on that sometimes it was necessary to observe a second day. If they were unsure, because they had not sighted the moon in time. You understand? So then in that case, they would add the next day too and make it into a Rosh Hashanah. Okay? But otherwise, in Eretz Yisrael, in the days when the Beis HaMikdash was in existence, and you had the Sanhedrin sitting in the Lishkas HaKozitz, you know, in the special chamber where they met in the Beis HaMikdash, and, you know, they would declare officially when they had seen the new moon, and that this was the first of the month, then in that particular case it was just 1 day Rosh Hashanah. Okay? Alright. So, the question now is, okay, look, this is the day after Rosh Chodesh, in other words, the day after the first day of Tishrei should also be a holiday? So they say, no, there's a difference, it says. Rosh Chodesh, the Oraisa. Rosh Chodesh is a day which was already ordained as a festival when? In the days of the Torah. Torah says, V'yom Simchaschem of Mo'adeichem, right? The days of your rejoicing, your festivals, of Rosh Chodeshem, and also on your Rosh Chodeshes, right? It's Katim, Batzotros, Halaloseichem, and you are, of course, to blow trumpets, you know, at the time that you offer your burnt offerings, and so on and so forth. In other words, Rosh Chodesh was a holiday that the Torah itself ordained for us. And this is why, even though it is not exactly in the same standing as a Pesach or a Shavuos or even a Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur or a Sukkot, right? But nevertheless, we know that in Rosh Chodesh, certain things we observe, you know, in order to celebrate the fact that it is Rosh Chodesh, okay? So he says, this is already in the Torah. Ude Raisa Le'Bnei Chizuk. And this is in line with what you asked me just a few moments ago. Holidays that are mentioned in the Torah, whether it is Shabbos, whether it's Yom Tov, right, or Rosh Chodesh, they don't need the additional chizuk, literally strengthening, that you also have to observe before, the day before, and the day after. Because people are going to observe them, because people observe the days that are mentioned in the Torah itself. Whereas those days that the sages had to establish at a later time, they needed this chizuk, they needed this strengthening, in the hope that people would be more careful about observing them, by also saying, we're going to observe also the day before as a holiday, and also the day after as a holiday as well. Days not to fast, not to mourn, and so on. Okay? Alright, so that is the basis over here.
Where does Rosh Chodesh fit along?
Rosh Chodesh is a semi-holiday. That's what we call it.
In the case of Rosh Chodesh, they can't do the day before.
In those days, right, to a certain extent, we do, but we don't necessarily. Right.
Because in those days, they had to wait for the moon to, for the
day before. Right, that's correct, of course.
So the day before, they wouldn't even know for sure.
Yeah, that's correct. That they could guess as follows. That, 29 days, the next day is bound to be something. The 30th day is bound to be something, okay? So they would look to see, whether it was Rosh Chodesh or it was not Rosh Chodesh, okay? And if it was not seen on the 30th day, then they observe the following day as the first day of the new month, okay? So that to this day, for example, this Shabbos, we're going to be benching Rosh Chodesh, okay? We'll bench Rosh Chodesh Adar Sheni. When is Rosh Chodesh? Rosh Chodesh is going to be Tuesday and Wednesday. Now, technically, Tuesday is what day? It's the 30th day of first Adar, even though we call it the first day of Rosh Chodesh, okay? Whereas, what is actually the first day of Adar Sheni? The answer is, that would be Wednesday, okay? So this is the way it works. That's the system, okay? All right. Yeah. The Tanya. As we have learned, Hayomim Ha'elet, these days, Haksuvim B'Megillas Tainis, that are mentioned, literally written in the Megillas Tainis, he says, Asurin, they are prohibited, Bein Lifneihem, whether we're referring to the day prior to the day, right? Bein Lachreihem, or the day following it. But, Shabbosos, the Yomim Tovim, Shabbos, and the major festivals, Haim Asurim, let's see, my eye was strained for a moment, all right, yeah, Yom Tovim, Haim Asurim, they are prohibited, right? In other words, the day of Shabbos is prohibited, or the day of Yom Tovim is prohibited, but Lifnehen, Ulachrehen, but the day preceding Yom Tov or Shabbos, and the day which follows Shabbos or Yom Tov, Mutarit, right? They are permitted, that you can do whatever you want on those days, right? What is the difference between one and the other? So it's what we said, Halolu. Those are Divrei Torah, in other words, Shabbos and Yom Tov are days mentioned in the Torah itself, right? The Yain Divrei Torah Srichen Chizuk, and things which are mentioned in the Torah do not require further strengthening because everybody presumably is observing them. They weren't aware, of course, of our American communities, right? But, in the days of the Talmud, the Jews observed, okay? But Halolo Divrei Sofer, whereas these additional days that are mentioned in the Megillas Tainis, they are only days that the rabbis themselves ordain as days in order to rejoice because of various miracles that took place at that time. The Divrei Sofrim and things that have to do with decrees made by our sages, Tzrichim Chizuk. They need Chizuk. They need strengthening. Okay? So, they go back again to the question again. The Sipa play, the Havala Yom Shalifnei Yom Shalifnei Ragbo Achikam Egedanya Ben Chakikam. But why can't we go back again to the say that the reason that we shouldn't fast on that day is because that this was the day before the day upon which Gedalia ben Chachikam was assassinated, right? So, and as we said before, if it's the days in which the Beis HaMikdash is in existence, then we said that we don't fast on that day anymore. We don't observe mourning, but instead we observe it as a day of rejoicing. So Rav Ashi said, Gedalia ben Achikam divrei kabbalah hu, v'divrei kabbalah k'divrei Torah domo. So in other words, what he's saying is as follows. He says, the Bible does mention the assassination of Gedalia ben Achikam, right? And Jews have accepted it as a tradition to do what? To fast on this day. And if Jews have accepted this as a tradition, then in that case, it's as if it were something which was mentioned in the Torah itself. Okay. So, you see, Divrei Kabbalah, right, is Divrei Torah. In other words, if people observe these traditions and continue to observe it year after year and so forth, then in that particular case it has the effect of this as if it had been ordained in the Torah itself. Okay.
It doesn't mean the day before and the day after.
Doesn't in that particular case, right. You're absolutely right. I mean, because if we say that it's treated like as if it were written in the Torah, then it means the day before is a day upon which we don't have to observe. Okay. Yeah. All right. Matzav Rav Tuva Bar Masna. So another kasha was asked this time about Megillas Titus. Rav Tuva Bar Masna said, "Be'esrim Tmanya Bay, on the 28th day of it." And the question is, of what? Are we talking about Tishrei now? The answer is no. Rashi explains that we're talking now that in the text of Megillas Titus, this is listed under what? The month of Adar. Okay? So that on the 28th day of Adar, Asas Kusota Tavto Yehudai, good news came to the Jewish people, right? The Lo Yehidun Yehraisa. That they would no longer have, literally, to depart from the teachings of the Torah. In other words, permission once more was given to the Jews that they could once more resume the practice of Yiddishkeit formally. Why? Because the government passed a decree that Jews are not allowed to learn Torah anymore, that they should not circumcise their sons, and that they should violate Shabbos, profane it, right? So in other words, the Roman government outlawed the practice of Yiddishkeit, whether it came to learning Torah, whether it came to performing a bris milah, whether it applied to observing Shabbos and Yom Tov and so on. Question is only, you know, what period? Because we have one period in which these decrees were, and these were, of course, during the days before Hanukkah, right? Decrees of Antiochus, right, that he prohibited. That's one possibility. But more likely over here, we're talking of a later period. Because, as they're going to say, the references that we have are to later sages, okay? So in that case, we know that following, first of all, the destruction of the temple, the Jews suffered at the hands of the Romans. And then what happened in the year 135, in other words, roughly about some 60 years after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, again, the Jewish people rebelled against Rome, right, under Bar Kokhba. And after their defeat, then the Emperor Hadrian, Adrianus Caesar, right, Emperor Hadrian passed these decrees prohibiting the practice of Judaism. Of course, he wanted to destroy Eretz Israel as a Jewish area and so on and so forth, particularly Yerushalayim, okay? So, now I'll say Yehuda ben Shamua v'chavirav. Pardon me. What did Yehuda ben Shamua and his companions do? Holchu v'notu leitzim matronisa achaz. They went in order to seek counsel from a Roman matron. Matronisa means, of course, a Roman woman of high, of nobility. Matronisa is, of course, from the Latin word matrona, from which, of course, we have the words mother, matron, and so on and so forth. Right. So matrona in Latin means, you know, a woman of high birth and so on, okay? Shekhol gedol Roma mitzuyin etzma. And the great, the nobles of Rome were always found, in her home. In other words, they frequented her home and they continually came to her, for counsel and advice and so on and so forth. In other words, she was highly established in Roman society. As a footnote, we may add that there was, among many Romans, a sympathy towards Yiddishkeit. Even though officially Yiddishkeit was proscribed at this particular time, but there were those who were sympathetic to Yiddishkeit, and in the days, particularly of the Second Temple, we had many people who were called, the Greek name was Theos Abominoi, which means people who feared the Lord. They were Goyim, who took upon themselves Jewish practices without formally converting to Yiddishkeit. But they felt that this was a way of life that they liked, and they wanted to participate in it, even though they were not ready, you know, to formally convert to Yiddishkeit. Okay? So, probably this woman was also secretly sympathetic to Yiddishkeit and to Jews. And we'll see what happened at this moment. So she said unto them, go and cry out at night. Today we use the word habginu in modern Hebrew as demonstrate. Go out and demonstrate it. But in those days the real meaning is tsa'aku. Go and cry at night. So they went and they cried out at night. Amru, and this is what they said. Ei shamayim, O heavens, lo achichem anachnu, aren't we your brethren? Velo b'nei ov echad anachnu, aren't we the children of one father? Velo b'nei em achatz anachnu, aren't we the children of one mother? Ma nishtaninu mikol uma v'loshon. Why should we be different from every other nation? She'atem goes rimolinu gezeres koshos. That you make all kinds of harsh decrees against us, right? Why should we be singled out that you should make these harsh decrees saying that we're not allowed to practice our religion when we are human beings, children of the same father and mother exactly as you are, okay? Ubitlum. And as a result, the Roman government canceled these decrees, the Oso Hayom, and so that day, when this took place, Asaruhu Yomta, right? They made it into a Yomta, okay? I'm going to stop at this point. I'm running out of steam. But we have just a few more lines to finish over here, so we'll continue from this point next week, okay?
We have a minute.
So we can say a Kaddish Drop Runner, what does I say? Okay. Tonight is the 8th of March, the year 2000. We are continuing now in Maseches Rosh Hashanah, Daf Yutes Omed Aleph, and we're roughly about three quarters of the way down at the bottom of the page. All right. We've just reviewed again the story about the Roman matron and her advice to the Jews that they should protest, that they should cry unto God, but also cry unto the authorities in Rome. Because remember we said that her house was a home where all the nobility of Rome would come in, they would always frequent it, so that therefore they screamed over there, and we heard the beautiful protest that they made, that we are all children of the same father and the same mother, we are all human beings, and therefore why should we be singled out for persecution? And as a result, the Roman government rescinded the decree. So, the Gemara now gets back to the question that started this. If you remember, the past page and a half or so, we're dealing with the question of one of the earliest books that we have, namely Megillas Tainus, okay? The scroll which contains the days of upon which to fast and upon which not to fast, where it's prohibited to fast. And in many cases, not only you're not allowed to fast, but also you're not allowed to make any hesped, any eulogy on those particular days, because they represent a day of salvation. Okay? So now, the Gemara gets back to a question that was asked before. Okay? And the question is whether the Megillas Tainus has been abolished or not, or is it still effective? And one answer that we had previously the other week was the fact that it was applicable for the times of the Beis HaMikdash, right? But after the times of the Beis HaMikdash, it was no longer applicable. Once the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, it was no longer applicable. That was one theory that was advanced. But then they asked the following question, which we had last week, namely, maybe it is still in effect, by virtue of the fact that we see what? That we see that days have still been added to it, and this is even after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. So we can't say that it ceased with the Beis HaMikdash, since this latest story, the one that we read, involves a scholar by the name Eliezer ben Shavua, right? And now they're going to trace what was the time in which he lived. So the Gemara continues. We're now six lines from the bottom, and it says, "V'yisal kadate." And if you are of the opinion that Botlo Megillas Tanis, that there's no longer a Megillas Tanis, it's been made null and void, so to speak, then are we going to say that Kamaisa Botl and Akronaisa Mosifit? Kamaisa meaning the first days that were mentioned over there. Are we to say that those days were abolished? Particularly what they have in mind is what? That what did the people ask Zechariah? Should we continue to fast on the fast of the fourth month, and the fast of the fifth month, the fast of the seventh month, the fast of the tenth month, right? And what did he tell them? Tell them that these days would be turned into days of Sosel Misipa, right? Of gladness and rejoicing. So, that being the case, then, are we to say then that those things were abolished, those fast days, but in the meantime, we keep on adding more? And if you say, yeah, taka, that's what it should be. Bizman shebeis hamikdash hayo, right? Taka, this is so, as long as the temple was in existence. But Yehuda ben Shamua, the one who was featured in the story, who told the people, let's go to Rome and let's protest, right? When did he live? He didn't live in the time when the Beis HaMikdash was in existence, but rather he was Talmido Shel Rabbi Meir. He was a disciple of Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir Basa Hochi Hava, right? And Rabbi Meir, as we know, was much after the period when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Ditnan, because we have learned a Mishnah, and the Mishnah says as follows. Kleis Chuchis, Shenikvu, the Hitiv Lesochon Avor, Omer Rabbi Shimon Ben Gamliel, Yehuda Ben Shemua, Metame Mishum Rabbi Meir. Okay. Here we go into a complicated problem. You know, from time to time, we've had discussions about things about Tumah and Tahara, right? It can apply to human beings. As, for example, a person comes in contact with a reptile, or a person comes in contact with a mist, or, you know, with a dead body, then in that particular case, it becomes Tomei. Now, when we say Tomei, remember, this is not something that we're talking about in our own day. We're talking about during the time that when the Beis HaMikdash was in existence, and then the word Tomei had much more greater significance, simply because if you wanted to bring, let's say, a sacrifice to the Beis HaMikdash, then you were not allowed to, you know, to be there unless you were in the state of Tahara, particularly if it involved eating from a sacrifice, because only a Tahor is permitted to eat from a sacrifice, okay? So, that being the case, they had to be aware, you know, what are the various things that cause Tumah, right? And then, of course, how you get out of the state of Tumah into a state of Tahara, primarily, of course, by means of immersion in a mikveh. Okay? This is how it's attained. In some cases, of course, let's say if a person were a metzora, a leper, right, or a zov, a person who was suffering from, you know, like a gonorrhea infection or something like that, then in that particular case, they also had to go through a process of purification, you know, not only by going into the mikveh, but by other means. As for example, in the case of Mitzora, they had to sprinkle him with, you know, hyssop that they dipped in Mayim Chaim and so on and so forth, to which they added the blood of a pigeon and stuff like that. So, okay, so it was not easy, you know, to get back again to a state of Tara if he was suffering, you know, from something like this. But as I say, in the average case, if a person had simply made contact, you know, with a dead body, then in that particular case, the mikveh might be the answer, but not in every case. Because in some cases, it also required that they have to be sprinkled with what they call the mechatos. In other words, the water that was mixed with the ashes of the Pora Aduma, okay? Remember, the Pora Aduma had to be burned. They took the ashes, they mixed it with Mayim Chaim, right, with water, right? And then the Kohen had to take, you know, a bunch of hyssop in it, right? Agura Sezov, and dip it in, and then he sprinkled you. So that was an addition to going to the mikveh. Okay, so, 1 second, Irv, okay, I just wanted to... Okay, okay, I'll tell you in a minute, all right? You ask a good question, but let's see what how it works together, okay? Tumor can also be in Kalim.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
It could be in Kalim. In other words, things that we use in order to eat. Vessels, dishes, knives, forks, and things like that, and so on, okay? They can also become tame by contact with somebody who is already tame, or by contact with food, which was tame. It might possibly also then convey tumor to even the receptacle, even to the dish, or whatever it may be in which it was concerned. Okay. The Torah has a passage in Parsha Matos. We'll read it towards the end of the Sefer Bamidbar, okay? Where the people of Israel are told that they have to go and wage war against the Midianites, okay? And after they waged war, so they took possessions, they took spoil, you know, booty from the Midianites, okay? So the mention is made over there that, you know, objects that are made of metal, gold, silver, copper, tin, brass, you know, these things, they have to be, they have to pass through the fire in order to become kosher. Okay. This is incidentally one of the bases of, you know, for what we call, koshering, you know, kosher, pans, pots, and things like that, and so on. Okay. So this is the ultimate source that we find in the Torah for it, okay? Now, metal and earthenware, okay, acquire tuma. Glass normally does not acquire tuma, okay? Doesn't absorb, so therefore doesn't acquire tuma. That's a normal rule, okay? So here we have the following case, okay? They quote that Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, right, quoted in the name of Yehuda ben Shabua, the same person who was mentioned where? In the story about the Roman matron, right? So obviously, from this we already see that it was at a later period than the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And we'll carry that a little bit further and we'll see exactly how that works out. The specific problem that we have over here is that kleis chuchis, okay, if they are glass vessels, shenikbu, in which a hole was made, if this glass vessel had become tame, right, how could it be restored to Tara? One way to do it was to make a hole in it, because once it could not contain, it couldn't hold the contents, you understand? It was as if it no longer had any value, and so therefore it could now achieve, you know, it could now become tahor, it could become clean, okay. But what if a person decided that he wanted to make use of it, okay? So what did he do? So he put into it avar. Avar is molten lead, which was used in order to seal the hole, okay? So he sealed it with this molten lead, and automatically, hitif means that he poured into it, because if it's molten,
it.
Right? So therefore, he poured into it this avar. And avar is, we said, I mean, this is molten lead, okay? So he poured into it, and now the question is now, as a result of this action, does it mean that the glass, you know, the glass is now tahor, or is it tameh? You understand? Does it still remain tahor after the, you know, the hole was made in it and then stopped up, or is it now back again to being a whole vessel, which therefore once more can revert to being tameh? You understand? Okay, and there's a difference of opinion over this, because what does it say? It says, first of all, the Rav Shimon Gamliel said that Yehuda ben Shemua mitame. He says that it now becomes tame, right? Mishum Rabbi Meir, and he says this in the name of Rabbi Meir. Shum in Aramaic means name. So Mishum, I mean, because in modern Hebrew, Mishum, we use it in a different sense, right? Yeah. Mishum, Sheh, you know, because of something or other. But Mishum, here in the Gemara, means in the name of Rabbi Meir. All right? So that's one opinion that says that it's Tomei. But as we take the next page, right, does everybody have the next page? Didn't give it out yet. Okay. Yeah. The Chachomim, but the sages, Mitaharin, they declare that it is now Tahor. Why? Because it is now a it is now a whole glass vessel. So even though there is lead in it, but the question is, to what extent would the lead take it out of the category of being a glass vessel or not? You understand? I mean, it's a technicality that we're talking about, but this is a dispute. So they say Tanoihi, right? It says that this is a machloikus, it is a controversy of the Tanoim. The Tanoim, if you remember, were the earliest of the sages of the Mishnah. Okay? Or among the early ones, anyway. Technically, I guess we would say, you know, that the first ones, the earliest ones, were called as Sofrim. Okay? And then after that, what became the title? Eventually we have the title of Rabbonim, okay? But those who taught Mishnah, or authorities, you know, who are quoted in the Mishnah in general, are called Tanoim. If they are already in the period after the closing of the Mishnah, then in that case they become Amoroim, okay? So these are some of the different chronological terms that we use for the sages, okay? All right, so he says that this is a machlekes of Tanoim, right? The Tanya, as we have learned, he says, and this is of course a Baraisa, which says, Hayomim ha'elu haksuim b'megillas Tanis, that these holidays which are written in the Megillas Tanis, back again to that, right? Bein bizman shebeis hamikdash kayam, bein bizman she'ein beis hamikdash kayam, and it makes no difference whether it is in the temple during the time when the temple is still in existence, or whether the temple is no longer in existence. But nevertheless, what? Asur. They are nevertheless days upon which it is prohibited to fast on those days. Divrei Rabbi Meir, and these are the words of Rabbi Meir. And Rabbi Yossi Omer, Rabbi Yossi says, Bizman Shebeis HaMikdosh, let's see, as long as the Beis HaMikdash is in existence, asurin, then these days are prohibited as days of fasting, right? Because it is a time, you know, for rejoicing. But ein Beis HaMikdash kayom, but the Beis HaMikdash is no longer in existence, then Mutarin, then these days now are permitted, you know, you're permitted to fast on these days, right? Because we are in mourning for the fact that the Beis HaMikdash is no more, right? So, v'hilchasa batlu, right? And as a result, we find that the halacha is that these days are bottled. In other words, that the fast, they are now regular fast days, right? No longer days of Simcha. The Hilchos Eloi Botlo. And another halacha says that they have not been abolished. In other words, these are still days of Simcha, not the fast. So, how could you have Hilchos Botlo and Hilchos Eloi Botlo? So they say, Kasha, Hilchosa, Hilchosa, right? It's a kasha of one statement that says that it's a halacha against another statement, which is, this is a halacha. So it says, no kasha. It says, no, we can resolve that. It's not a kasha. Why? Kan b'chanukah Purim, kan b'sha'or yomi. In other words, he says, Chanukah and Purim, then these are holidays mentioned in Megillas Tainis, not to fast, and that still is the procedure. That still is the proper law. That's still the halacha, okay? Whereas other days that were mentioned, you know, days of victory, days of good news, and things like that, and so on, these have been abolished. So they're no longer in effect, and that's it. All right, yes?
I lost me somewhere along the line. I still don't see the connection between the pot and the
okay. I didn't go into every technicality. Okay.
To specify what period
right.
Rabbi Yehuda ben Shmuel was.
Yeah, right, right.
Were able to pin down
right.
that the dispute about the pot was resolved, yeah. Well, it was resolved by Rabbi Yehuda quoting Rabbi Meir.
Right.
Rabbi Meir, the
correct.
Decision. We know that Meir lived, let's say,
lived
between
after.
The period of the destruction of the temple in Bar Kokhba, that 70-year period.
Yeah, okay.
Wasn't Rabbi Yehuda the one that went to Rome as an emissary? He was a diplomat, so to speak.
There were different people who went to
yeah.
Rome from time
he
to
was
time,
very,
right? Because
Rabbi
Yehoshua also
oh, yeah,
was very
Rabbi
close.
Yehoshua,
was,
sorry,
yeah. But you're right, Rabbi was also close in his time. Right. Rabbi Yehuda Adossi was close also to the Roman government, right? Because if you remember, we read, we learned some time ago about the fact that he and his household, they learned Greek.
Right.
Why did they learn Greek? So that they could talk to, you know, the people in the government. Remember that at the time when Rome was at its height,
right.
the fashionable language among the Roman aristocracy was not necessarily Latin. Because they learned Greek, they studied Greek, and, you know, it was considered, you know, a part of being the role of a well-educated gentleman or lady, you know, to be able to speak in Greek. Just as, for example, I remember once looking at War and Peace in Russian, okay? And I discovered, lo and behold, in the middle of all the Russian over there, they have French again and again and again. Why? Because the Russian aristocracy back in the early 1800s, Russian was for the ordinary people. But what did the aristocracy speak? They spoke French. So that being the case, this is somewhat similar, you know, back in the days of Rome. Okay, so that's why Rabbi Yehuda and his household, they studied Greek so that they should be able to negotiate with the government authorities, okay? And discuss philosophy and law and religion, etc., etc.
Which you pointed out that some Greek words found their way into all sharp.
Oh, yeah. You'll find. We find plenty of Greek words, some Roman words here and there, right? The word matronisa that we had in the story, obviously, that's from the Latin word matrona, which means, you know, a matron, in other words, a woman of high society.
Apotropos
is Greek.
Right,
which means somebody literally. Who is in charge of feeding you?
Yeah.
Okay, from the Greek word, you know, apo, which means above.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Oh Or epi. I mean, epi. Probably epi is a little bit closer to it, right? And the trophos, which is profane, which means to feed. Yes.
So this whole exercise is merely to prove that the Megillus
Titus
was still in force after the destruction of the second temple.
That is correct. Absolutely right.
I mean, so what is
it every day?
Why do they go through this whole thing?
They go through the whole thing to show, first of all, how could you presume to say that things that were mentioned in the Bible, right? Those fasts, they were, you know, they were bottled, right? They're no longer in effect because they were turned into days of Simcha. And then what happened after the destruction of the temple? We said that they go back again, they revert to being days of fasting, right? And yet here, at a later period, was still declaring what? A holiday. A holiday because the Jews rejoiced when they heard that the decree against the practice of Yiddishkeit was abolished. So how could we reconcile that? We can't say that, you know, Yehuda ben Shemua was still in the days of the Beis HaMikdash, and then rely upon the statement that with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, Megillas Tainis ceased to function. You understand? When here is something which came in after. So we finally come to the fact that after discussing it pro and con, then they finally come to the conclusion that what? That in general, Megillas Tainis has been abolished. In other words, these days have reverted to the status of being ordinary days and no longer days of Simcha, right? But with Hanukkah and Purim, they remain permanently, as we said the other week, because of the miracle that was connected with them. Okay? So that this is the reason why, you know, those are days upon which we are prohibited from fasting. Okay? So this is what it boils down to now. So with that, we sort of finished up with Megillas Tainis, and we come back again now to, back again to, the sending out of messages, of emissaries, right? Who were to spread the news that the Beis Din had done what? That they had proclaimed Rosh Chodesh, right? And that being the case, we learned from the Mishnah, remember? The Mishnah says that there are six such months in which we send them out. Obviously, those that are connected with most of the major holidays, okay? But it also mentioned the fact, if you remember, that it said that they sent them out on Elul, Rosh Chodesh Elul, because then people would be able to figure out when approximately Rosh Hashanah is going to be, right? And then it says, and they send them out in Tishrei, if they takodas ha-mo'ados, right? Because you want to establish what are the correct days for the other holidays. Yom Kippur, for Sukkot particularly, you know, when to celebrate it and so forth, okay? So, obviously the question is, why should they be sent out, you know, just 1 month apart, okay? So that this is what we're now going to discuss, okay?
Excuse me.
Yeah.
I have a question. I thought the custom was they lit fires to
light. Okay. They did that Boreshona, in other words, at the beginning. And this was something that worked very, very well until what? Until the sectarians, whether they were the Christians or whoever they were, they wanted to put, you know, a kibosh in it so that they lit bonfires on the wrong day in order to purposely lead the people astray. You know. It's like going and finding these pamphlets for, you know, Jews for Yoshka and something like that. This was what they were doing in those days, okay? They didn't publish pamphlets in those days, so instead they lit the bonfires on the wrong day in order to lead astray the people of Israel. Yeah.
Just a technical question. I mean, how many, or maybe we're getting into this, but how many messengers did they send out? Did they send out to everyone?
Well, obviously, I don't know whether there's an exact number that's mentioned. But first of all, messengers normally would have to travel at least two or three in a pair, okay? Right, after all.
Security.
Well, yeah, security, and sometimes one person has to relieve himself while the other person stands guard or whatever it may be, and so, you know. They're all, they're human beings, you know. So, as a result, they sent them to various areas, but particularly they wanted to let the people in the nearer part of Babylonia know when it is. Yeah, it was primarily for the sake of Babylonia. Of course, for Eretz Israel too. But Eretz Israel, it was a little bit easier, you know, to send messages and get the message across. But, you know, to get as far as the Golan, as far as Babylonia. This really was quite a distance, you know, from Eretz Yisrael. But originally the bonfires did the job. But the Shekil Kelu Haminin, you see, when they put the Kadash on the whole ideal, so then they abolished it and they decided that they simply had to send people who were the emissaries of the Besdin, who obviously carried the proper credentials stating who they were. Because Tom, anybody comes running around and say, hey, the Besdin sent me, you know, and they want to know who, what, when, where, you know. They have to have facts that they have to know. So obviously they had the right credentials for that. Okay? All right. So, the Gemara now asks the following questions. It says, Kevin, I'll level the Rosh Hashanah, right? That's what I quoted. The Mishnah, right? The Altisha Gibnei Takonis Hamonis, right? In other words, they would send out messengers for Rosh Chodesh Elul, so that people would know when Rosh Hashanah is coming, and on Tishrei also they sent them out so that we would know how to, you know, what is the correct date of the festivals that follow in the month of Tishrei. So the Gemara says, "Kevin the Nafke Lehu Ayelul." Inasmuch as the messengers went out in order to proclaim, you know, when is Elul, Tishrei Lo Melehu. So why do they also have to send out messengers to inform the people when? Was it necessary to send out just a month later for Tishrei? After all, people should have been able to do what? They should have been able to figure out, you know, when all the holidays are going to be, since they know when to expect Rosh Hashanah. Since at the beginning of Elul, they were told when that was. Okay. That's a good question. We'll come to it in a moment. Okay? Okay. All right. So, the Gemara says, okay, yeah, Lomeli, right, Lomeli, what do we need it for? And then it continues and says, V'chi Teimor, and if you argue as follows, Dilma Yibruha Le'elol, maybe they made an extra day in the month of Elul, in other words, that the Elul had 30 days, right, instead of 29 days. V'amar Rav Chinina Bar Kana, didn't Rav Chinna, the son of Kana, say, Omar Rebbe, in the name of Rav, that Mimos Ezra Ve'elech, from the time of Ezra on, Lo Motzinu Elul Me'ubor, we never found that the month of Elul should be Me'ubor, literally, you know, to have an extra day, okay? So in other words, normally Elul always has 29 days, and from Ezra's time on, we never found that it should have 30 days, right? So therefore what? So therefore the people would know that the 30th day is now actually the first day of Tishrei. So why would it be necessary to send out again to tell when is the first day of Tishrei, right? Yeah. So you move it right. So he says, Lo Matzinu. It says, Lo Matzinu, right? We didn't find, didn't happen. So he says, the Lo Itzirich. Because it was never necessary during all these years, you know, to have the month of Elul have 30 days. Okay? It was never necessary for it. But Ha Itzirich. But let's say there should be a good reason why we would have to declare the month of Elul as having 30 days, then it says Marbinin, and in that picture Marbinin, right? In that case, the Besdin is empowered in order to, you know, to make it a month of 30 days.
But wouldn't it have to be coincide with the phase of the moon at that particular time?
Yeah, but, you know, remember that the question is, how much of the moon has to be visible in order to declare that it's Rosh Chodesh? Obviously, if it's completely black, you know, then it's not Rosh Chodesh yet, okay. But the minute that a sliver of moon is found, okay. But there are cases where they could not necessarily declare it. One of the basic principles we've discussed a few times. There's a Gemara that says that Rosh Hashanah you know, it can never occur on certain days of the week. Why? Like, because, for example, if Rosh Hashanah were to be on, let's say, on Wednesday, okay, then in that particular case it would mean that Yom Kippur would have to be on Friday. No. Because remember, Rosh Hashanah is, right, it's always 2 days, right? If Rosh Hashanah would be Wednesday, then Friday would be Yom Kippur. We don't want to have Friday as a an Erev Yom Kippur. Okay? By the same token, we also don't want to have Yom Kippur occur on a Sunday. Because, you know, here you have Shabbos, and then from Shabbos you go into Yom Kippur. It's also, it's not a good combination. So that, therefore, I mean, today our calendar is already arranged in order to avoid all that. Okay? The other one, incidentally, was in connection with Hoshana Rabbah. They didn't want to have Hoshana Rabbah occur on the Shabbos. Okay? Because they wanted to be able to carry around the Aravas, you know, the willows and the Beis HaMikdash and have the Hakafas and things like that, which they would not be able to do on Shabbos. So, exactly. So, in that case, they could add an extra day in order to get out of it. Generally speaking, well, of course, I mean, we're living in an age where since the 4th century or so, whatever it is, all these things have been figured out in advance so that we know that all these conflicts are automatically avoided. We also know that the month of Elul always has how many days? Always 29 days. So that the possibility of having the 30th day of Elul is, you know, something that cannot exist in our day. But in the days when the Beis HaMikdash was in existence, and they had a Sanhedrin, even after the Beis HaMikdash was finished, was destroyed. But in Yavne, you know, the Academy of Yavne, which was headed by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, they still continued to declare, you know, when was the new moon, and they continued it probably for several centuries yet after that. It was in order to make sure that the principle of Lekadesh Asachodesh Al Pira Iyah, in other words, of declaring that the new month had now become, literally sanctifying it by visual sight, was still carried on. So there was always a possibility. So this is what he says then. If it should ever be necessary for the best thing to do it, then in that case, then they do it. So now they say, Sahar Mikalka Rosh Hashanah, but if you add another day to Elul, isn't this going to destroy or mix up, you know, when should Rosh Hashanah be? Correct? Yeah. Because, yeah, they'll be celebrating Rosh Hashanah when it's still the 30th day of the month of Elul. So it'll be on the wrong day that they're celebrating Rosh Hashanah. This is the fear, you know, particularly, you know, those who are in the Gola, who are too far away from Eretz Yisrael to get the news immediately, okay? So it says, okay, so mutav to kalkul Rosh Hashanah v'leis kalkul u'kul madu. So he says, it's better that the mistake should be made with Rosh Hashanah, but at least let them know with all the other holidays when is the correct date. So that's the reason why what? That's the reason why in Tishrei too they send out a message. Right, to make sure that they know. Okay? Dalkanami, look at it and you'll see that this is exactly what the language is telling us, the Katani, that because we've learned Al Tishrei Mipnei Takonas HaMoados Shmaninu. In other words, they do send out for Tishrei in order to make sure that the holidays are in the right time, right? And this proves the case. Shema Minor always means, Shema Minor at the beginning means, let me show you something, you know, to bolster my argument. But Shema Minor, when you add at the end, it means always, and that's, you know, so I proved my case, so to speak, okay? Yeah. I rest my case. Okay, good. All right, then the Mishnah continued and says, we are kislei b'nei Chanukah, bread, v'yaladu b'nei Purim, that they would send out shluchim from the Besdin in order to inform people when you know, is Rosh Chodesh Kislev, so that they would know how to calculate when is Hanukkah. And likewise, about Adar, right, because of Purim. All right, so far so good. So now, we have another teaching. And the teaching says, V'ilu nis Abra Hashona, and if the year actually became an Ibiyor, in other words, if they added an extra month to the year, exactly as we had, you know, beginning today as being the first day of the Adar Sheni, right? In other words, if they now declare that we have to have an Adar Sheni, so in that case, Yotze Nafal Adar Sheni, if they are Purim. So the Shluchim have to go out again in order to inform people when is Rosh Chodesh for Adar Sheni, so that they would know how to celebrate Purim in the right time, right? So he says, Lo Katoni, how come that we don't have that mention, you know, that what? That they should send it out also for Adar Sheni. It only mentions for Adar, but it does not mention for Adar Sheni. Why doesn't the Mishnah also mention Adar Sheni? Right, that's the question. Right. So he says, Matzlisin, the local Rabbi. So he says, because the Mishnah is not in accordance with Rabbi. The Tanya, as we've learned, the Baraisa, which says, Rabbi Omer, he says, Im Nisabra Hashono, Yotzin Af Aladar Sheni, Bipnei Hapurim. Okay? He is the opinion that if, you know, it is an Ibiyor, in other words, the Bezdin declared that it is now a leap year, then in that particular case, they have to send out Shluchim, even to inform people when it's Adar Sheni, because they should know when. You know, to celebrate Purim in the proper time. So, Leimor b'Hokum Iflegei, are we to say that now the Machlekes that we have, the difference of opinion, is on the following grounds. The Mar Sovar, one authority is of the opinion, Kol Mitzvos HaNohagos B'Sheini, Nohagos B'Rishon. All the various mitzvahs that are associated with the celebration of Purim in the second Adar are also applicable to the first Adar. In other words, what would be the implication of this particular authority's opinion? That when the 14th of Adar Rishon comes, what should we do? We should read the Megillah, right?
Yeah.
We should give Baton Islev Yonim, give to the
right.
Poor people, right? Make a Purim Suda, and so on and so forth, right?
Right.
But we should do it both in Adar Rishon and also in Adar Sheni, right? According to this opinion. Omar Sovar, but the other authority, in other words, the one upon which Rabbi relied, is Kol Mitzvos HaNogos B'Sheni, all the mitzvahs connected with Purim that we observe in Adar Sheni, Ein Nohagos B'Rishon, right? We do not observe them in Adar Rishon. Is this what the basis of the Machlokes is? I mean, you know, as to why Rabbi says that you should send out Shluchim also to inform people when it's Adar Sheni. So they say, no, no. The reason why it's not mentioned is, Techulei Almo, everybody knows that mitzvahs are nagos b'sheni, ain't nagos b'rishon. Everybody knows that in Adar Sheni, the things that we observe, we do not observe in Adar Rishon. Of course, I'm talking about the celebration of Purim and the mitzvahs over there. By the way, what do we do in Adar Rishon with Purim? What do we do? We have what we call Purim Katan, right. The day upon which Purim Katan, and the next day, Shushan Purim Katan. Those are 2 days that we omitted the Tachnun on those days. So it was a festive day, but it's not Purim, okay?
When's the fast?
The fast is always prior to, in other words, it's going to be Monday, Erev Purim, okay?
But do they fast the first of Adar? In the first month?
No, no.
Okay.
No, no, not at all, because if you don't... look, if you're of the opinion that all the mitzvahs, then in that case you should fast also. But since everybody is in agreement that you don't observe in Adar Rishon those things that are connected with Purim, so therefore you don't fast either. Okay? Yeah. Of course, that brings us back. I just want to, you know, because from time to time we have this problem. according to the Shulchan Aruch, and this is the practice that we follow, okay? If a person passes away in the month of Adar, and it is not a leap year, then in that case, you observe Yahrzeit both in Adar Rishon and Adar Sheni. If a person passes away in a leap year, then in that particular case, when another leap year comes afterwards, you observe only in that particular month. In other words, so a person were to pass away, let's say, on the 12th of Adar Rishon, right? So the next time a leap year comes, he observes only the 12th of Adar Rishon, but not the 12th of Adar Sheni, and vice versa, the same idea, okay? But if a person passes away simply on the 12th of Adar in an ordinary year, then our custom is to observe Yahrzeit both the 12th of Adar Rishon and also Adar Sheni, okay? All right, but that's as far as Yahrzeit are concerned. It is not, however, as far as Purim is concerned. With Purim, Purim is always observed in Adar Sheni. Why? For one reason, because the Gemara says that there are exactly 30 days between Purim and Pesach. Exactly. So that being the case, that means that you want to have Purim in the month which is closest to Pesach. Okay. So that's one of the primary reasons, because we want to join one with the other. This is why when we have, the special Shabbosim that we have, so Shkolim and Zohar are connected with Purim, right? And then Purah and Chodesh are connected with Pesach. And of course, right prior to Pesach, I have Shabbos HaGadol, okay?
I just want to get this right. In a leap year, if your Yahrzeit occurs on Adar Sheni, then when another leap year comes, you only
observe
it on Adar Sheni.
That is correct. Correct. Sometimes, of course, you have funny things that happen in an ordinary year. A person who passed away, let's say, on the 12th of Adar Rishon, right? And another person passed away on the third day of Adar Sheni in the same year. Now, obviously, which is the later day of death?
Sorry.
Yeah, it would be the second one, right? The one on the third day of Adar Sheni. But when it comes to the Yahrzeit in an ordinary year, that person actually, that Yahrzeit will be observed prior to the one,
right,
the other one.
Right.
All right, so it's one of these things, that's all. You accept it and that's it. Yeah. The question was asked of me today about, that we stop saying after 11 months, okay? All right. What do you do in the leap year? Do you go right through another month because it's a leap year or not? The answer is no. We stop at the end of 11 months and that's it. So in other words, usually between the time that we stop and the Yahrzeit, there's a month's difference, right? But in a leap year, so there'll be 2 months difference and so on. But we don't do it any more than 11 months. Why? Because our custom is we don't want to say that the person who passed away is a Russia. A Russia is punished. Remember, we had the discussion some time ago, how long is the punishment of the Rishoyim, right? So one authority says it doesn't last any more than just 12 months, right? We don't want to say that they're Rishoyim, so we stop short of 12 months. We always stop a day prior to the beginning of the 12th month. Okay, so that's the way it is. All right. Having touched upon these different halachas, we'll do a couple of more lines and call it a night over here. All right. So, right. Okay. So it says, no, the chulayalmor. Right? Yeah. It says, no, the chulayalmor, everybody's in agreement that mitzvahs are nugas basheni and nugas barishon. That, the mitzvahs that we carry out in the second Adar in connection with Purim are not observed during the first Adar. The Hacha B'Yibishonah Kamiflikei. But he says, the Machlokes really was about a different issue, namely, declaring that the year is a leap year. The Tanya, as we have learned, Kama Yibishonah Lamed Yud. One opinion says, how many days are involved in an Yibishonah? In other words, how many days do we add in order to make it you know, a leap year, right? So one says that it is 30 days, okay? Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, you learn me Chodesh. He says we add a month. So you say, Maishtor Lamed. So what is the difference between 30 days to Yadeh? We say it's because people know they can count 30 days. Chodesh Nami Yadeh. So people also can figure out, more or less, you know, when is a month. So Omar Rapopo said, Mande Omar Chodesh, the one who uses the word Chodesh, a month, Rotsa Chodesh, Rotsa Shloshim. He says, that's all the same. If he wishes, he can call it a month, or if he wishes, he can call it 30 days. Okay? Hey, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. So Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi gave testimony, Mishum Kehela Kadisha de Yerushalayim, in the name of the Holy Congregation Yerushalayim, right? Al Shnei Adorim, that whether it is first Ador or second Ador, it makes no difference. In both cases, Shemekachin Osim Biyomi Burehem, that they declare that they are holy days, and the day in which, they are declared that this is the beginning of the new month. So he says, the Meimu de Chaserin Adinan, is this to tell us, in other words, that if it is not a complete month, in other words, it was only 29 days, then they'll do it, but Malayim L'Adinan, but if it is going to be 30 days, they don't do it. So he says, La Fuke, this is to, in opposition, with the Dorash of Nachman Vachista, from what Nachman Vachista taught. He says, Heyed Rabbi Simai, Mishum Chagai Zachariah Malachi, that Rabbi Simai gave testimony in the name of Chagai Zachariah Malachi, those were the last three of the prophets, Al Shnei Adorim, in connection with two Adors, Sheim Ratzu La'Soysen, if they wanted to do them, Shnei Himalayim, then they could both be 30 days Olsen, right? Shnei Chaserin Olsen. If they want to make it both of them 29 days, they do so. Echad Mole V'Echad Choser Olsen, right? And if they want to make one 30 days and one 29 days, so they can do it also. V'Chacho Yenoh Hagim Bagola. And this is what was the custom in the Galut. Mishum Rabbeinu, in the name of Rabbi Omru, they said the Yolam Echad Mole V'Echad Choser. Always, they said, one is a full month. In other words, the first Adar contains how many days? 30 days. The Echad Choser, and second Adar contains 29 days. And this is the normal thing to expect. Ad sheyivod alecha, until you should learn that what? Shehukba Rosh Chodesh Bismano, that Rosh Chodesh has been proclaimed by the Beis Din in its proper time. All right, we'll stop at this point. I just want to point out that to this day, what is our practice? Our practice is that first Adar always contains 30 days, and second Adar always contains 29 days. And by virtue of the fact that second Adar is always 29 days, this is what makes it possible that we have, as I said, 30 days from Purim to Pesach, because otherwise we're going to have the problem of 31 days. And 30 days is what the tradition calls for. Okay, so we'll stop at this particular point. All right, tonight is the 15th of the month of March. Yeah, Ides of March. Beware the Ides of March.
You have an answer for Julius?
Yeah, right.
Julius, by the name, was threatened to Jews.
Yes, he was.
I suppose
yeah.
Sicily was under the first place.
Absolutely true, right.
Julius was
Jewish Caesar, right. He permitted Jewish recruits in the Roman army to keep Shabbos and things like that, yeah.
Sicily was under
Okay, so tonight is the 15th of March, the year 2000, and we are currently Rosh Hashanah, Daf Yutes of the base, almost down at the bottom of the page. Okay, we are in fact five lines from the bottom right now. Okay, and So we now shall continue with the third word on the fifth line to the bottom. Shalchu lei lemar ukba. They asked the following question of Mar Ukba. Ador hasomach lenisan le'olam choser. So this is what they asked. They said, tell me, is Ador, which is closest to Nisan, is it always choser? Choser, remember, means that it only has 29 days. Okay? So this is the question. Is it true that the month of Ador closest to Pesach is always 29 days? Because we had a statement before that there was a tradition that the first Ador would have 30 days and the second one would have 29 days, but that nevertheless it is possible that it's not always so. Okay? Of course, again, we're not talking about our calendar today, where second Ador, or Ador in an ordinary year, is always just a 29-day month. Okay? Said that just a few moments ago, as we heard. Okay. So they asked him the question, is this so? So Masa Rab Nachman. So Rab Nachman asked a question based on a statement that we had in the Mishnah, which says, Al Shnei Chodoshim Mechalonis HaShabbos Al Nisan V'Al Tishrei. Okay, he says that there are 2 months when the witnesses are permitted to be Mechalel Shabbos. Now, Mechalel Shabbos, not in the sense that they're permitted to do every action contrary to the laws of Shabbos, but specifically that they are permitted to travel, as we would say, more than a Tchum Shabbos. So you're aware that there's a pasuk in the Torah speaking about the giving of the manna, and there's a statement over there which says, Al Yetze Ish. Okay, it's the exact quotation, right? So therefore, that has been explained in various fashions, you know, it gives rise to various dinim that we have, various laws that we have, and one of the laws is that you're not allowed to walk more than a Tukum Shabbos on Shabbos. So the question is, of course, what is a Tukum Shabbos? The answer is that based on a comparison with a later statement that we have concerning the cities of Lumiyim, so we know that the Tchum Shabbos is Alpayim Amo, 2,000 cubits, which would translate to roughly about, let's say, 3/4 of a mile or something like that, okay? So, of course, alright, so now, of course, I'm only stating what the law says, but how it's applied is already a different story. Tchum Shabbos starts from where? From the furthest point
of the city,
and you can go, in other words, 2,000 cubits beyond that, assuming that there is no contiguous habitation over there. In other words, why are we permitted to walk, for example, from Springfield into Longmeadow? More than 2,000 cubits. The answer is because you have houses going all the way, right? So that, therefore, it doesn't apply, right? You have houses.
Houses,
yes. You have houses all along over there, right? So that being the case, so then it acts as if it were one big area instead of being, you know, one big local area instead of, let's say, you're in the country someplace, and you walk more than 2,000 cubits, there's no houses or anything like that, technically you should turn around and come back again and not violate Shabbos by doing it. So
2,000 beyond the limits of the
city. Beyond the limits, right. Then, of course, that leaves another exception to the rule is if you make an Erev within 2,000 cubits, you know, beyond the boundary, and of course you have to make an Erev Shabbos and bring in some food over there so that you can have it for a Shabbos meal, then from that point on you would be allowed to go another 2,000 cubits.
And you're hoping to get there on Shabbos, the animals didn't eat it.
Yeah, right, okay. I'm
reading some memoirs of
put it into a food locker.
In the early 1900s, where somebody made a film every Shabbos to go visit the relatives of the next place, And every Shabbos morning when you get there, the animals are eating.
Right. Okay. So at any rate, since this rule of, you know, Trim Shabbos applies, but the question is, here these people are performing a very, very important mitzvah, and that is to let people know exactly when is Rosh Chodesh, as proclaimed by the Sanhedrin, by the Beis Din in Yerushalayim, or subsequently, let's say, by the Beis Din in Yavne, which was the successor to it. So, therefore, they gave permission for these people to violate that particular aspect of Shabbos. But not, you know, to go wholesale and violate Shabbos, any rule in the book that they felt like it, that they couldn't do, okay? So, this Mishnah then says that there are 2 months upon which the Beis Din gives permission to the messengers to violate the law concerning Trum Shabbos. And one of the 2 months, one of course is Al Nisan, Rosh Chodesh Nisan. People should know when was Rosh Chodesh Nisan. And the other one is Be'al Tishrei, right? And the other one is, when is Rosh Chodesh Tishrei? Obviously, it's very important for us to know both the Rosh Chodesh of both of these 2 months, because to take a look. If a person knows when is Rosh Chodesh Nisan, then he knows that Pesach begins on the 15th, okay? How does he know when Shavuos is going to be?
50 days after.
Yeah, 50 days after the beginning. In other words, you start counting on the 16th day of Nisan, and then you count, you know, 49 days, and then the 50th day after that is going to be Shavuos. So that already takes care of 2 of the 5 major holidays, okay? When are all the other major holidays, in other words, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Sukkot? The answer is, that's in the month of Tishrei. So if people know when was Rosh Chodesh Tishrei, they know when was the exact date that Rosh Hashanah should be observed, or should have been observed, right? And on that basis, they can figure out that Yom Kippur is the 10th, right? And that Sukkot begins on the 15th. So for these two, the rule was that they suspended this particular rule concerning the shluchim, you know, the people, the emissaries of the Beis Din who go out in order to inform the Olam when it was Rosh Chodesh. Now, yes.
Let me ask you a question.
Right.
Adar Hashan, Adar Sheni.
Yeah, right.
We really don't know from year to year when is at the time before the calendar was fixed.
Right.
We didn't know when there was a Libya.
That's correct.
So we didn't know whether Adar was going to be 1 or 2.
Right.
So,
correct.
So if you say for Nisan, you don't know whether it's going to be a second Adar or not, because that day was determined only at the very last moment.
Yeah, this is going to be one of the problems. Exactly.
Very technical.
Right.
Year to year.
Yeah.
They didn't count
all. No.
They couldn't tell by the way.
No, because remember one thing that's very vital to this whole discussion that we're engaged in right now, and that is that in order to proclaim Rosh Chodesh, they actually had to have witnesses to see
a new moon,
okay? And it had to be, the witnesses had to appear before the court, and the court had to examine the witnesses and confirm the fact that their testimony was correct. And then, at that basis, then they said that it's now Rosh Chodesh, right? Or
yes.
They would say Mekudosh. Okay, it's holy, yes.
But in
sanctified.
Terms of
yeah.
The leap year,
yeah.
Couldn't they tell as they were coming, as the months were moving, that the season was going to be...
Okay. You ask a legitimate question. The answer is that the Gemara in Sanhedrin, for example, brings some examples that, you know, it may be that because of this and this physical condition that the year should be declared a leap year. But it was never declared a leap year until the court itself, until the Beis Din itself, had declared that this is a leap year. In other words, you didn't have a pocket calendar in those days, a pocket luach, to tell you that automatically this year, the year Tov Shin Samach, is going to be a leap year, and therefore, you know, the first Adar is going to contain 30 days, and the second Adar is going to contain 29 days.
Well, I guess
yeah.
The question that I'm
yeah.
asking is, when we get to need a leap year,
yeah.
the adjustment is made so that the season should be right.
Correct.
So how far... how close to the time would they wait before declaring
the The answer is about the month of Shvat, okay, they would begin looking for these various signs, and then they still had time during first Adar, during the month of Adar, to decide whether they should have an additional month or not.
Yeah.
Okay?
Either last year, Sisley, I forget which one, was a typical example. Usually 1 month is a full day year of 30 days, and 1 month is a full year of 31 days. I think it was last year.
But we never have a full month of 31 days.
29 or 30,
right.
But
yeah.
I believe last year, there were 4 months, one after the other, which was 30 days, to make sure that the first day of Pesach comes on a specific day, otherwise the whole rest of the year, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, would have been lopsided.
Yeah.
I think it was last year.
Yeah. I don't recall specifically, you may be right about that, but actually this is going to be one of the things that is going to enter the discussion about what is the latitude of the Beis Din in making such a decision, based upon how will it cause problems for the Jewish community, okay? And this is, we'll see, particularly in connection with Yom Kippur and Shabbos, what to do. All right, so we'll come to that. Okay, all right. So, to continue then, we see then that the Beis Din is empowered to send out shluchim for the month of Nisan, for the month of Tishrei, in order to inform people as to when is Rosh Chodesh, right, and they're permitted to violate the law of Trum Shabbos in order to inform the communities. This is the Chiddush over here, okay? But the Mishnah itself mentioned actually that there were 6 months upon which they did it, okay? So that they did it for other reasons as well. But at this particular point, we're concerned with this particular Baraisa, or this particular Mishnah over here, and what is its effect upon the question of whether you're going to have, you know, a leap year with two Adars or not, and how will people know whether it is? This is the problem that they're going to face right now. Only in the sense of desecrating the law concerning Tchum Shabbos, how far they could go. Okay? I discussed that before you came in, about the law of Tchum Shabbos, that you're allowed to go 2,000 amos beyond the boundary of the town in which you are, provided, of course, that there's no contiguous housing. But if you have contiguous habitation, then in that case, you can go even further. Well, about riding a horse is Shainananda Maisa, okay? All right. Yes, we're almost finished at the bottom of Yutes Omid Beis and ready to begin Chav in another moment. Okay. Yeah. So, the law is as follows. Or rather, the discussion at this particular point is as follows. It says, Iyamid Bishlamor, if you tell me that Zimnin mole, Zimnin choser, right? That sometimes Adar is full, meaning that the month of Adar is going to contain 30 days, but at other times the month of Adar is choser, it contains only 29 days. Then, in that particular case, they say, Mishum Hochi, for this reason, then, the Chalulina, right? And in that case, we can see that the communities have to know exactly whether the month of Adar is going to have 29 days or 30 days, because that will determine, also, you know, might give a hint for when Pesach is. But nevertheless, notice that the reading over here doesn't say that, you know, that it is for the sake of knowing when Pesach is going to be. Because the Mishnah said that actually they have to send them out in order to inform people when is Nisan. So that therefore, obviously, you have two things then. It doesn't follow automatically, at least it didn't in those days follow automatically, that after, let's say, 29 days of Adar, automatically it was going to be Nisan. It might be maybe after 30 days, because this was all determined by what? By sight, whether they had seen it or not, okay?
This is all pre-Purim. The calculations we're talking about now was before Purim was...
Well, according to an earlier Mishnah that we had, even for Rosh Chodesh Adar they would send out, okay? And the reason being so that people would know when to celebrate Purim, just as they sent them out for Kislev, and all the people to know when to celebrate Chanukah. This was the previous Mishnah, okay? But here they bring in another Mishnah, and they want to discuss at this particular point, what is the application over here? How does it work out? So he says, but, this is now the next page, Chaf, okay? That's over here, here is Chaf. Right? It's Chaf. Ella, let's begin with the word Ella. Yeah, okay, this is it. Yeah. Yeah. Ella, but, I'amrit liyolam chaser, if you say that the month of Adar preceding Nisan is always 29 days, then in that case, amai mechalalinim, why would it be necessary to give permission to the shluchim, you know, to go out and violate the law concerning, you know, not to travel on Shabbos? Why would it be necessary? People could automatically say, look, I know when was Rosh Chodesh Adar, right? Count 29 days, and automatically I know that it's Nisan. And everybody would say that. Well, if that's the case, then why do they have to have special emissaries to go out and, you know, to inform people when actually is Rosh Chodesh Nisan? Okay? This is the question. So the answer is, Mishum de mitzvah lekadesh al harayah. Alright? Because it is a mitzvah for people, that is for the Beis Din, to actually declare the new month by sight, so that you don't rely simply upon the law of probability, but you do have to rely upon did people actually see the new moon and report it to the Beis Din so that the Beis Din could come back then and make an official proclamation. Stan, you have a question?
Why do you have to send two people out? Where? Just look up in the sky and then send you to the
sun? Note maybe where people lived, maybe it was cloudy and they couldn't see.
Every month?
No, it's Trefzik. I take a look at the Jerusalem weather report every day in the newspaper, and many times Jerusalem, so it says cloudy over there.
If the new moon wasn't seen by the 30th festival, or the man is declared.
Yeah, all right, that's another story. I mean, that's right, because then people know. Right. But as I say, it's a mitzvah for the Beis Din to actually take a look and have the witnesses come, etc., etc., and do it, you see. It's a mitzvah for them to do it, yes.
Well, you know, he's asking why they didn't do it in town. Wasn't it a specific place, an open place away from town where they had a clear view and it would go for everybody?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're talking about in town,
yes.
Here in town, you know,
yeah.
It might be sighted here and then maybe not quite cited elsewhere.
Well, we can understand. Look, I don't know that the smog situation was as bad in those days as it is today. But as I say, clouds definitely could happen. There's no question about that. And that's why it had to be an official proclamation. But as I say, it's a mitzvah that there should be an official proclamation. You understand? This is the point. It has to be, you know, officially coming from the Beis Din in Yerushalayim. Yes. Sure.
During, war with the Babylonians, or also the prophets,
yeah.
The temple was being destroyed.
Yeah.
Did the Sanhedrin do it in the middle of war one time?
Well, okay. The answer is that they tried to function to the best of their ability. Okay? How do we know this? Okay. First of all, there is a tradition that says that 40 years prior to the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, the Sanhedrin already left the Lishkas HaGozis, in other words, the special chamber of hewn stone, which was in the Beis HaMikdash, which was the, you know, the seat of the court, the site of the court, whatever you want to say, right? And they started to go into Golos, so to speak. In other words, they wandered from one community to another. Okay? So, in their wandering, sometimes we were able to avoid. Now, eventually, of course, what happened was that the Beis Din eventually was located in Yavne, where Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, carried on the traditions and tried to carry on as much of the rulings as possible, things that used to take place in the Beis HaMikdash. And of course, on the basis of the rulings of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, this is why we do certain things to this very day, even though originally they were only restricted to the Beis HaMikdash. I'm talking about blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah. I'm talking about, that's one of the outstanding things, okay? That, for example, the use of the lulav and the esrog during Sukkot. I mean, specifically, originally, the law of blowing the shofar was where? Not in every shul, but it was in the Beis HaMikdash, okay? But Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did not want the mitzvah of blowing the shofar to be forgotten by Jews. And therefore, he instituted the fact, that we should have the blowing of the shofar everywhere. Wherever Jews gathered together and so on, they should have blowing of the shofar. There was a more serious problem in that. In the days of the Beis HaMikdash, when there was only one day, Rosh Hashanah, if it was Shabbos, they still blew shofar, because in the Beis HaMikdash, certain things that we call Shavuos was overridden. Whereas, outside of the precincts of the Beis HaMikdash, the laws of Shavuos, which means, in other words, you're not allowed to do certain things that otherwise might have been permitted, but you don't do it because it violates the sanctity of the Shabbos and will lead to actual transgressions, okay? So, he ordained that only where there was, a Sanhedrin there, it would be permissible to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah on Shabbos. Whereas, otherwise, we know that we don't blow it, right? Whenever it's Shabbos, Rosh Hashanah, then we don't blow that day, that's all. And the same thing applies that in the Beis HaMikdash, the first day of Sukkot, if it was Shabbos, then also they would take the lulav and the esrog in those days, okay? Of course, what happened was the people had to bring an Erev Shabbos to the Beis HaMikdash. They tried to recognize their own. If not, they were taught by the Kohanim to say, I give a matana, my lulav to whoever it is, so that there won't be any violation. And everybody was taught to do the same thing, so that it would still be technically within the realm of what we call, that it has to be lochem, which means it has to be mishalochem. It has to be your own lulav and esrog when you make the bracha over it, okay?
Yeah.
But they did it on Shabbos in the Beis HaMikdash. They did not do it on Shabbos outside the Beis HaMikdash, okay? Mm-hmm. Naturally, we don't do it on Shabbos, yes.
On Shabbos, did they bring
korban? Of course.
So they had to have fire?
Yes, yeah. Yes,
fire
absolutely.
Was
right.
Fire was there, still.
Yeah. Since you're asking about korbanos, there are two types of korbanos. Okay, one is what we call Korban Sibur, and the other one is called Korban Yoch.